Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of economic news that affects our jobs, our incomes, our debts, what we buy and sell. In short, the national and even the international dimensions of economic life in our society. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach in the graduate program for international affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write a regular column for truthout.org, a courageous and independent source of news and analysis. Do check them out at truthout.org. If you're interested in the materials and the analyses we present on these weekly programs, please make yourself helped by, if I can use that term, the websites that we maintain and update on a regular basis that enrich and extend what we do on this program. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites gather materials for you, analyses for you, video, audio, blogs, an enormous array of materials that we want you to make use of in whatever way you can. At those websites, you can also sign up for our regular newsletter, which will bring some of these things to you and alert you to what else is available on the websites. And likewise, both websites allow you to communicate with us, to send us your ideas, your questions, your criticisms, your suggestions. We use them in designing the materials on this program, and towards the end of each hour, I respond to a couple of them. Please bear with us. We can't answer all of them. We are very fortunate to have as many of you communicating with us as you do, but do understand we can only pick a few to respond to. And again, the websites are rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Turning to the updates, the short ones with which we begin each week, today's have a common theme, and that has to do with the relationship between our economic system, capitalism, and health issues that we have as we go through life. So let me begin with several instances of what that connection can sometimes be. I begin with a story from last week about an intern working in the Bank of America Merrill Lynch office in London, England, by the name Moritz Earhart. Very young man, 21 years of age, has worked in several banks as an intern. But this time was the last time. He was found dead in his apartment after three nights of 15-hour days. It turns out that people who work as interns are in deep trouble these days and are being overworked systematically. Let me just give you a bit of information about Mr. Earhart in London. According to a professor who studies this, Chris Roebuck, the Cass Business School, he told the Financial Times, apropos of the death of this young intern, that, quote, "For reasons related to an individual's ambition or the current employment market, people are pretty desperate to get jobs. Some employers," he continued, "are exploiting this fact, pushing people past the point where it makes sense for their health." Well, this demands a bit of a comment. I chose this example, sad and tragic as it is, because Mr. Earhart is part of an enormous group of people who are being exploited. And I've talked about this on the program before. But before I spoke mainly about how they're exploited in terms of being paid often nothing at all for their work, being worked long hours, being paid very little in a few cases, basically being told, "You're lucky to put this on your resume, and we're not going to have to pay you. You need us, and we don't need you." What I wanted to add now is that the level of overwork is so extreme that it is killing people. And of course, we don't know how many, and we don't know what long-term health effects this kind of extreme overwork does. But an economy that breaks down the way ours has over the last few years since this crisis hit is an economy that drives people in ways that cost us our health. And yet no one measures quite the cost of that part of an economic crisis, even though they should. My next update refers to a recent book, and I want to cite the authors and the book before telling you what they find. The authors are David Stuckler and Sanjay Basu, B-A-S-U. The title of the book, The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills. Mr. Stuckler is a professor at Oxford University in Great Britain, and Professor Basu works at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. In their book, they are most famous for their discussion of the relationship between economic crisis and suicide. Let me show you what their findings are. In the United States, the suicide rate, which had slowly risen since 2000, even before the crisis hit, really jumped in the period 2007-2009. In their book, the two authors estimate that there were 4,750 excess suicides in the period 2007 to 2010. That's almost 5,000 more people killed themselves than we would have expected given what the rates were in the prior years. Death from economic crisis. The trauma, obviously, to the people who kill themselves, to their families, their friends, their coworkers, their employers, their employees. It's astonishing. And again, this is a cost of economic crisis that is rarely counted when the costs and benefits of having a crisis, dealing properly with the crisis, spending money, as our leaders in Washington don't want to do to overcome this crisis, the cost of this is measured in lives, whether it's a young intern in London or it is suicides in the United States. The two authors also go on to compare countries who, during the crisis, decided to cut social programs versus those that help people's well-being and health versus not cutting them. And every time they looked at it, when you cut the health and welfare expenditures on your people in your country, their suicides and their health problems shot up. And when you didn't, they didn't shoot up. The lesson here is crystal clear. David Stuckler, Sanjay Basu, The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills. My next economic update deals with, again, the relationship between our economic system and health issues. This time the focus is not particularly on the crisis, but on the way our economic system has been working for a long time. And here I take my cue from an article by Ronnie Rabin, R-A-B-I-N, that appeared on the New York Times blog, the newspaper's blog, and has to do with her write-up of an article that appeared in April of this year in the journal Psychotherapy and Psychosomatics. Here's what it found. Two-thirds of a sample of more than 5,000 patients who had been given a diagnosis of depression over the previous year did not meet the criteria for administering the drugs, the antidepressant drugs that were in fact given them. Well, when I saw that, I began to look into it, and I found the following. Over the past two decades, the use of antidepressants in our economy, that is long before this crisis hit, the normal functionings of U.S. capitalism has produced a rocketing of antidepressants. One in 10 Americans now takes an antidepressant medication. Among women in their 40s and 50s, the figure is 1 out of 4. Depression has become a common disease. And the single most important reason, quote, economic struggles have added to our stress and anxiety. Wow. Here's another reason. Television ads promote antidepressants. Insurance plans usually cover them. Even the plans that do not cover talk therapy, seeing a psychotherapist as opposed to taking drugs. But now we have another reason. Doctors are over-prescribing antidepressants. Well, let's put all this together. The economic problems of our society, the tensions, the long-term decline in standards of living of most people in Europe, North America and Japan, is causing people to have serious psychological and emotional difficulties. Number one, economics, mental health problems. Number two, the drug companies take advantage. They advertise on television. They stimulate the doctors in our society to prescribe too often. Wow. The profit motive is pushing the use of these medications as a way of coping with the economic problems our system gives us. The system gives us the problem, and then the system gives us the profitable solution in antidepressants. I don't think I need to draw the implications of that for anyone. Finally, in last week's news, yet another example of the economy and health. The United Parcel Service, the largest distributor of packages in the United States and in other parts of the world, announced a change in its policy. It is no longer going to cover the spouses of its employees, as it had been doing. The law in the United States is a little bit peculiar. It requires an employer to provide medical insurance for an employee and his or her children. It doesn't mandate it for his or her spouse. So the United Parcel Service has decided that it needs to make more profits, and it can do that by lowering its costs and telling the spouses of its employees, we're not going to cover you. We want you to go to your other employer to get that coverage. Interesting. Interesting. This is yet another sign, not that we needed it, that corporations around the world, particularly in North America, Europe, and Japan, under pressure for the profitability of their activities there, are finding ways to accommodate. And if that lessens the health benefits for their workers, so be it. So much for the health discussion. I don't want to get folks depressed. Let me turn to something else, which may have, unfortunately, the same result. But please remember, I don't create the news that I bring to you. I'm just the messenger, and you're supposed to have a place in your heart for the messenger that distinguishes him from the message he unfortunately may be bringing. Last week, the largest bank dealing with home mortgages in the United States announced it is eliminating 2,300 jobs for its employees engaged in providing mortgages to homeowners or in helping them refinance a mortgage if they already have one. That is, borrow again at a lower rate to replace the older mortgage they had that was at a higher rate. That's called refinancing. And why is Wells Fargo doing this? Well, the answer is simple, and everyone knows it, even if we pretend otherwise. It's more profitable to Wells Fargo. It's a way to avoid being hurt with costs. They're never going to employ people unless they make money off of that, unless they get more revenue from employing a person than it costs them to pay that person. Or to say the same thing again, in other words, they have to get a surplus out of every employee. They have to get more than they pay for. That's the game. And so Wells Fargo decided that 2,300 of its mortgage bankers and mortgage operators are not needed, and it's firing them. It's not a problem for Wells Fargo that that worsens unemployment. They simply said interest rates in America are rising, therefore fewer people are going to be able to afford to buy a home, fewer people are going to have any reason to refinance their home, we're not going to make money off of it, you're all fired. They have no responsibility beyond what makes them money, and if you don't make them money, you're history. 2,300 people added to the unemployment rolls by Wells Fargo Bank, the recipient of huge bailout by the American people in their time of difficulty, once again show what their concept of repaying the public might be. Let me turn now, if I can, and ask your indulgence to enter into a few of the larger kinds of discussions of bigger issues than these small thumbnail updates with which we begin our programs. Today's has to do with an issue of a journal. And it's not a journal I normally bring to your attention, but as I do, and in my capacity as an economist, I read some of the publications of the official association in the United States that most economists are members of. It's called the American Economic Association, the AEA. It publishes a group of journals of varying kinds for the varying specialties and interests of its members. And one of them is a Journal of Economic Perspectives. And in its summer 2013 issue, its latest issue, it has a couple of articles that are so interesting with results of research so pertinent that I wanted to make sure my listeners, my viewers, are aware of it. The first one that I'm going to talk about that appeared in that issue of the Journal of Economic Perspectives, by the way, volume 27, number 3 is the exact issue of that journal. The article is called The Top 1% in International and Historical Perspective. The leading author is Alvaredo, and there are several others, but you can find the article if you're interested and read it, which I would urge you to do. Here we only have time to talk about some of its major conclusions and their implications. First, one of the results achieved by these authors in that article was that they found no relationship. In statistics, it's called no correlation between top income tax brackets in the industrial countries, Europe, North America, and Japan, and so on. No correlation between the income tax bracket and the rate of growth of the economy. Now, let me explain why that's important. Over the last several years, conservatives in the United States and abroad, people in the Republican Party in the United States, in the Conservative Party in Great Britain, and so on, around the world, have coined the phrase job creator. And the idea that they have made crystal clear in endless repetition goes like this. It's important to cut the taxes on rich people, because by doing that, they will have money that they will invest in the economy, making it grow, and thereby leading to more jobs being created. In other words, don't tax the job creator, because if you do, he or she will create fewer jobs. And if you don't tax them, they will create more jobs. Isn't that wonderful? The research of the four economists published in the official Journal of Economic Perspectives produced by the American Economic Association, which studied the relationship between income tax on the rich and job creation, found, ready? No relationship at all. In other words, it isn't true that cutting taxes on rich people creates jobs. It hasn't been true historically, and it isn't true now. Not in the United States, not in Europe, not in Japan. What does that mean? It means that the argument to cut taxes on the rich people is an argument that the rich people put out because they want more money. It has nothing to do with job creation. They don't want to be honest and say, we want to keep more of our money and give the government less. So they rather play the game of suggesting that by taxing them less, we will have more jobs. Not true. Doesn't fit the facts. Proven false in this article once and for all, even though I don't expect the folks that don't care about this argument to pay it any mind at all. But there are more interesting conclusions in this story. The authors also ask the question, how do we account for the growing gap between well-paid people, high-paid people, and everybody else? And here again, their research undercuts a nice conservative argument. The conservatives have tried to argue that the reason some workers, a small minority, are getting better paid is that they have more skills, that they have more education, that we can explain the growing gap by a gap between the better educated and the worse. This is a nice way of explaining inequality of income as being the fault of the recipient. It's a blame the victim game. It's very old. Their research shows no correlation between changing skill distribution and changing income distribution. Just not there, folks. And you know, they point out with a certain humor, tongue-in-cheek, that if that were true, we'd have a hard time explaining the first part of the 20th century, when the gap between high-paid and medium and lower-paid workers was much narrow. You'd have to believe that something bizarre happened in the first half of the 20th century that made the gap between better-skilled and less-skilled people much, much less than it is today. And there is no evidence to support that. So we see we can't explain higher incomes because these people are more productive, better educated, higher skilled. No, no. Turns out they're getting paid more because they had the political muscle to affect the rules of the game, the tax rates they have to pay. That's the bottom line. And they document how those who were able to get more money were able then to manipulate the tax laws to relieve themselves of taxes, which left them with more money to use to play the political game, to cut their taxes in a back and forth kind of vicious for us, virtuous for them cycle. I found these articles very interesting for the reasons I've hopefully made clear to you. But I want to take it a step further. I want to suggest that these authors have also missed something. There's a more fundamental, if you like, reason why a small percentage, 1%, 5%, 10% of people are earning a great deal and everybody else is having a hard time. And that reason has to do with something that happened around the 1970s. And I'm going to use the United States as an example, even though the story isn't all that different in Europe and Japan and so on. In the 1970s, something fundamentally changed in the United States from the previous century or more in this country. Over that century, roughly from the Civil War to the 1970s, real wages in America rose. Decade over decade, the actual amount of money related to the prices people have to pay when they spend that money rose. Workers' standards of living rose. Their real wages, what they could buy and consume, rose decade over decade. Those are the 100, 125 years during which Americans began to believe that they lived in a charmed place, that every generation would do better than the one before, that there was something built into the United States that made all of this happen because it wasn't happening to working people in most of the rest of the world. It's true enough, it wasn't happening over there. It was happening in the United States. But the reason wasn't mystical and didn't have to do with our climate or the Lord or much of else that was thought of as the explanation. It had to do with a labor shortage in the United States. That across that whole period of time, the United States was peculiar because capitalists had come from Europe to set up businesses here, running away from all kinds of problems in Europe, by all means, and they found here a population they basically got rid of, leaving them with virgin soil, no real competition, good climate, good harbors, and they were profitable in their little businesses. They had everything they needed with one exception, workers, because they got rid of the local population. They needed to bring more people from Europe. They brought them by paying higher wages. They didn't have that problem in the American South because they didn't have to pay wages there. Those were slaves stolen from Africa. But for the Northeast and the Midwest, the major growing parts of the United States, the only way to keep our system going was by bringing workers here. And to do that, you had to raise their wages. And even when they got to the East Coast from Europe, you had to keep raising their wages, otherwise they'd run into the interior to become farmers, which is what most of them had been in Europe anyway, on all the land taken from the Native Americans and made available at little or no cost. So wages were raised in the United States to solve the capitalist problem of insufficient workers. In the 1970s, that situation changed. And there were basically four reasons I want to go over with you. First, American corporations, having raised the wages of American workers for 100 and 125 years, as I've just explained, didn't want to keep paying these high wages and were beginning to move out of the United States to other parts of the world where they could pay much lower wages because they hadn't had 125 years of labor shortage. Number two, capitalist employers, besides moving production out of the United States, were bringing in new technology, the computer, which allowed them to do the same thing with many fewer workers. And so they laid off large numbers of workers. They didn't demand, they didn't need workers the way they did before because the computer was a technological automation substitute. At the same time that capitalists needed fewer workers, because they were leaving the country and because of the computer, there was a raft of new people looking for work. Most important, American adult women. Partly because of that women's liberation movement around that time, the desire of women to have job opportunities and career opportunities and life experiences that were like what men had available to them. They wanted jobs and they moved into the labor force in sizable numbers to get those jobs. And finally, we had another wave of immigration like we have had so often. Not from Europe this time, mostly from South America. If you put together the capitalists leaving the country and substituting computers, demanding fewer workers, at the same time that we have women and immigrants moving in who want and need and deserve jobs, you have the perfect situation for employers. They see more people looking, then they need to have jobs. So the first thing they did was stop raising wages the way they had the previous 100, 125 years. So since 1970s, the real wages in the United States have basically been flat to down. For example, the average weekly wage in the United States, adjusted for the prices you have to pay, is significantly lower in 2013 than it was in 1972. That's right. In terms of what you can buy with your average wage, workers are less well off, significantly less well off than they were 40 years ago. That raises the following question. Workers haven't been getting more. They've been getting less. At the same time, partly thanks to the computer, workers have become more productive. That is, an hour of a worker's work yields more goods and services than it did before. The productivity of American workers, because they're better educated, because they work longer hours, because they're pressed to work harder, for all those reasons, and they have more machines and better machines, they're more productive. Well, let's translate that into English. A worker who's more productive means he or she is giving more to the employer to sell. But what is the employer giving the worker? Less. Over 35, 40 years. Worker gives employer more. Employer gives worker less. No wonder the people at the top are singing a tune of enormous wealth. They've been cashing in for a long time. And this has nothing to do with skills, and it has nothing to do with this is a simple story in which employers found an opportunity to give their workers less at the same time that they took advantage of technology and other conditions to get more and more out of their workers. There lies the root cause of the inequality documented and researched in this article. Let me quickly turn to, well, let's not. Let me stop at this point. It's our midpoint in the program, and take our usual short intermission. Please return with me. This is Economic Update. Richard Wolff will be back in a moment. Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I am Richard Wolff, your host. I want to remind you as we go into our next substantial discussion of an economic issue that I want to bring to your attention and develop for you, that you can pursue these kinds of analyses on both of our websites, which I invite you to visit. rdwolff with two Fs .com is one. And Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info is the other one. Both of those websites will allow you to sign up for our free newsletter if you'd like to receive that, which brings this kind of analysis to you, and also allows you to communicate with us if you have questions, comments, criticisms, that we read each and every one of those in order to shape our programs. I want to turn next, and again, I'm talking about that remarkable issue of the Journal of Economic Perspectives, summer 2013 issue. We spent the last quarter hour talking about one of the major articles in that issue, and now I want to talk about another one. This one is authored by, again, a group of writers, but the first one whose name comes at the beginning, so it'll help you find the article if you're interested, is Adam Bonica, B-O-N-I-C-A. Okay, and the article is called, Why Hasn't Democracy Slowed Rising Inequality? So here's this very interesting and profound question. Every poll we know of, past and present, shows that overwhelming majorities of Americans believe and support and advocate a distribution of wealth and income much less unequal than the one we actually have. That's right. Americans systematically prefer, desire, believe in having much greater equality, less inequality in the distribution of wealth and income than what we actually have. Well then, if the vast majority want less inequality, why have the last 30 years consistently produced more inequality in income and wealth? The only reasonable conclusion is that the democratic preferences, the democratic choices of the majority are not effective. They don't work. Either that majority can't express its views, or it expresses its views and they just don't matter. It is a fundamental challenge to any claim of democracy in the United States or any other country if you can show, as all polls do, that something the majority consistently wants for decade after decade is systematically frustrated by the government and the business community that are supposedly also committed to the democratic ideals that the country is founded on and claims not only to support, but to lose blood and treasure to bring to other societies. So these researchers ask themselves the question, why might this be true? And in their research, they came to decide that it might be worth looking at the two political parties here in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats. And of course, as I'm sure all of you know, it's pretty easy to determine, at least over the last century, that the Republican Party has been less upset, I'm trying to be polite here, less upset by income and wealth inequality than the Democratic Party. That the Democratic Party, at least coming out of the Great Depression, the last time our capitalist system collapsed and destroyed lives left and right, and incomes, and hopes, and futures, and all the rest. The last time, coming out of that, the Democratic Party, built around Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, became a party that at least said it was in favor of less inequality, less extremes of wealth and poverty. So these researchers said, well, let's see, has anything happened to the Democratic Party that might explain why, when everybody wants less inequality, we in the United States get more and more of it for 30 or 40 of the last years? And they found what they believe is the answer, which is presented in this article. They looked at the sources of financial support to the Democratic Party in the United States. And they compared 2 years, actually compared many years, but the beginning of their time, looking at history, was 1980, so 33 years ago. And the second year they looked at was 2012. As I say, they looked at other years, but I'm going to take the beginning and the end. And here's what we're going to show you. I'm going to relate to you. They asked the following question. How much of the money that the Democratic Party took in, its organizations, its groups, and its candidates altogether, how much of the money fueling the Democratic Party machine came from individuals who gave the equivalent of $1,500 in any given year? Well, that's really interesting because that's a tiny number of people, especially back in 1980, but even now. Very few people give that kind of money to a political campaign. Those are people who are well off. And the second question they asked, to make it even sharper, was to say, what portion of the money collected by the Democratic Party came from the top 0.1% of Americans? That is, the richest 1/100th of a percent of Americans. These are people earning millions of dollars a year. And here's what they found and what I want to comment on. In 1980, if you put together the people rich enough to pay $1,500, but not in the top 0.01%, together with the top 0.01%, in other words, the richest Americans, they contributed 17.2% of the Democratic Party's money in 1980. Fast forward to 2012, looking at the same people, the people who gave the equivalent of $1,500, because these numbers have been adjusted for inflation, so it's the equivalent wealth of a person in 1980 and in 2012. If we look at 2012, what was the percentage of the Democratic Party's money coming in that came either from people who gave $1,500 or more, or were in the top 0.01 richest Americans? And the answer is 51.5%. Let me recap. In 1980, the richest Americans accounted for 17.2% of the Democratic Party's money. In 2012, the richest people in America accounted for 51.5% of the Democratic Party's money. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand what this means. Basically, what we see is that the Democratic Party, its party organizations, its groups, and its candidates now depend for most of their money on the richest people in the society. What might have been true of the Republicans is therefore now true of the Democrats. Mystery resolved. Problem disappears. Explanation obvious. When a political party is dependent for most of its money on the richest people in the society, the likelihood that it is going to systematically oppose their interests in becoming richer is, let me be polite, slim. Slim to nothing. Of course the Democratic Party cannot and will not protect middle and lower income people. It is not a machine or an organization that depends on them. It needs their votes, but above all it needs the money of the rich to put on the spectacles to win the votes. That's how the political machine operates. If you didn't want a political party to frustrate the majority. You'd have to have a political party responsible to, accountable to, and financed by that majority. But it is the height of naivete, of gullibility, to imagine that a party that gets most of its money from the richest people is going to undercut their desires in order to meet the desires of the rest of us. Thanks to the Journal of Economic Perspectives for having the courage to commission and to publish that kind of research, and it's been a pleasure to bring it to you. Okay, in the time that remains for us to talk today, I want to respond to some of your questions and criticisms, and particularly to continue from the end of our show last week, where we began discussing the problem of what capitalism is. Let me recapitulate and then carry that forward as I promised I would do. Mostly capitalism as a system has been distinguished from socialism or communism in the following ways. Capitalism, the definition goes, the old definition, is a system of private enterprises. Private individuals own and operate businesses, whereas in socialism and communism, the old definition goes, it isn't private individuals, it's rather government that does that. The government owns and operates businesses, not individuals, not private persons. And the other big distinction, and there are really only these two, the other big distinction is that in capitalism, the way we distribute the goods and services that are produced is by means of markets. People bargain with one another over the price of something. I give you X dollars, you give me a haircut or a hamburger or whatever it is. Companies do that with one another. The market is the mechanism for distributing the resources and the goods and services we produce. And there again, the distinction from socialism and communism, not markets. They have government planning. They have agencies of the government that basically tell producers, you send this portion of your output over there, and you will have this amount to consume in the supermarket over there. It's a government bureaucracy and planners who make those decisions rather than market exchanges among buyers and sellers. So that's the old definition. And the whole of the 20th century was supposed to be a great struggle between capitalism on the one hand and socialism slash communism on the other, such that capitalists had private enterprises and markets, and socialism and communism meant government enterprise and government planning. We should have known better than such simple-minded definitions, but they were convenient to all kinds of folks who were happy with those. For example, the businesses in America, the privately owned businesses, were always and remain frightened that people's dissatisfaction with them will lead them to demand government enterprises. So they need to demonize those as evil, as socialism and communism. So the government ownership is very bad, and they want to associate it with everything else that's bad, like socialism, communism, and all the bad things associated with that. And in a peculiar twist, the leaders of places like Soviet Russia and the People's Republic of China also want to stress to their own people how major and fundamental their break has been. They overthrew capitalism to bring in a better world. So they need to kind of overdo the difference there, pretend that the capitalist world is private and markets, and we here in Russia or China or wherever else, we have government enterprise and we have planning. The truth of the matter is, as I'll show you in a minute, is that these definitions really don't work very well. And let's go through it briefly. First of all, capitalism is full of public enterprises. Capitalism has, for example, public postal system, often has public utilities in many capitalist countries, public transportation systems. Amtrak in the United States is a public entity. They have public entities controlling the money supply. Something as fundamental as that is typically controlled by a central bank, which is part of the government apparatus. And in many countries, they have public companies producing all kinds of things, public transportation, bus companies, subway companies. They're public. In other words, in many capitalist countries, all kinds of things are government-operated enterprises, where the government hires people, the government produces output, and the government sells it. The second thing, the way to show this, is that in many private capitalist economies, the market isn't used at all. That is, the government comes in and plans things. I already mentioned one. The government runs the money supply. The government plans how much money, literally, to produce and circulate in the economy. That's a planned arrangement. That's not a market system. That's a planning system. Likewise, the government interferes and controls things. We don't allow markets, for example, to settle what the wages are. We don't allow workers to bargain with employers for their pay below a certain amount. It's called the minimum wage law. We say the market can work, but at this point, the government comes in and says, you can't pay less than this. That's not a market. That's a planned system. Likewise, the government distributes food to people who need it, in schools, for children, in disaster. That's government planned distribution. That's not market distribution. The government owns and operates land and the distribution of land in large parts of the United States. The government controls the skies, the harbors, has rules and roads. This is all government planning. We can call it whatever we want, regulation, rules, limit. We can play word games, but it's the government planning what happens rather than leaving it to the market. That's all over the place in capitalism. Wow. So capitalism has public employees, public enterprise, and planning, doesn't it? Yeah. So it's not the system of private enterprise and market the way the old definitions would have it. And the same applies. It's really interesting. The same applies in the Soviet Union, People's Republic of China, and those societies. So let's do the work. Do they have private enterprise? Of course they do. Let's start with the Russians, the great example of the last century of a socialist economy. The Soviet Union begins in a revolution in 1917, and the first act of the revolution, the first act, is to say to the mass of people who are peasants, farmers, because Russia in 1917 was an overwhelmingly agricultural society. Most people lived off the land. The first thing the Soviet Bolshevik leaders did, Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, and the others, was to give the land to the mass of people as their private property. That's right. To establish private enterprises, farms, for the vast mass of the people, and to say that the Soviet Revolution guarantees that that is their property. That's one of the reasons why in the first 10 years of the revolution, the revolutionary Soviet government had the support of the mass of the Soviet people, because it had provided, you guessed it, private property. So the notion that socialism and communism has nothing to do with private enterprise and private property, that's just ignorance to think like that. It means you don't know, and you've been taken in by these old definitions. Nor did it stop. Even after the so-called collectivization of agriculture in Russia in the late 20s and early 30s, the rest of Soviet history, until the 1989 when it collapsed, was a system of collective and big farms, but on each of them there was a private plot that each peasant family had for themselves. Yep, private property and a little private enterprise. And the family was allowed to grow whatever they wanted on that. Chicken, eggs, grain, vegetables, it didn't matter. That was private property, private enterprise for the family. And that was sanctioned throughout the history of the Soviet Union. So did the Soviet Union abolish private enterprise and private property? Not at all. Not even a little bit. Okay? That's very important to understand. Did they have a big government enterprise sector? Yes, they did. But that's a different matter from saying that you can define socialism as the negation, or communism as the negation of private enterprise. And when it comes to markets, the Soviet Union always had markets. And those markets were systematically maintained and sustained. Workers got paid wages for their labor. People who produced goods and services got paid in markets where they sold those things. The government sold, individuals sold, there was a market all the time. Did the government manipulate and shape the market? Yes, it did. Just like governments in capitalist societies manipulate and shape their markets. So the distinction that capitalism is private enterprise, private property, and markets, and socialism is public enterprise, public property, and planning, that just doesn't work. Because both these societies are, in fact, mixes of these. And the mixes shift and change. But it's no way to distinguish them. It's no definition that really works. But here's one that does. Ask yourself the question. Could there be something that could really distinguish a capitalist economic system from a socialist economic system if the old definitions don't work? If societies are constantly showing us mixtures of public and private enterprise, of markets and planning interacting with one another. Next week, when we continue this discussion of the definitions of capitalism, I'll provide you with a definition that makes the distinction between capitalism on the one hand and socialism and communism on the other clear, nicely separated, so we can begin to see where one ends, there the other one stops, and we can think about how the world is working these days in terms of a better definition of the great contesting systems, capitalism on one hand and socialism and communism on the other. In the few minutes that we have left, I do want to talk to you about a very interesting worker self-directed enterprise that has come to my attention. As you know, I like to provide, as we do often on this program, examples of workers who have gotten together and produced a different kind of enterprise, an enterprise which doesn't have a hierarchy, no major shareholders who select a board of directors who make all the decisions versus a mass of working people who come to work who have to live with those decisions but are not allowed to participate in them. I want to celebrate that that is happening, that that's not just an idea that workers can run an enterprise themselves, that they don't need a hierarchy, that there is another way of organizing an enterprise and a whole economy. And I want to make sure that that's understood as not to be pie in the sky, not a utopian dream, but a concrete reality that's all around us if we can see it and we can learn to recognize it when we're looking at it. So here's an example from the United States that I thought you might enjoy with me. And here it is. It's the Black Star Co-op. The Black Star Co-op. And what is it? It's a brew pub. That's right. It's an enterprise that both brews beer and serves it in a public house or a pub, as we call it. This one is located in Austin, Texas. And I want to tell you a little bit about it to close our show today, because it illustrates what's possible if you know how to think in new and creative ways about economics. It all started back in 2005, well, quite some time ago, when a group of folks interested in beer and brewing in Austin decided they'd like to set up a community brew pub, something that really would respond to the community and not just be a money-making outfit. So they looked around, and to make a long story short, they found that they could take advantage of a new law in Texas that specifically allows setting up such corporations. And so they did that in 2006, called their first meeting, invited the community to get involved and understand the benefits of a community operation. They asked the community if they believed in it enough to invest in it, to put up the money to help set up something that would really be a community service in the way of a pub and a brewery. they raised $325,000 from member owners. Folks became members of a cooperative community having this as their project. Everybody gave a little. By the way, how many? The co-op itself now has 3,000 member operators. So it's $100 a person to have a community brew pub. And they're very successful. They started out their co-op in 2010. And here are the results as of the end of 2012. Black Star Co-op has 23 workers who democratically and collectively run the business. They have 3,000 members in the community who also participate in running the business. A business run democratically by the workers in it, cooperating with the community it serves. Wow, what an interesting idea. All decisions are made collectively and democratically by the consumer and the worker. There is nobody else, no board of directors, no stockholders, no investors. The people who depend on the service, together with the people who provide it, workers and customers together running a successful business in Austin, Texas, Black Star Co-op, look them up. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I want to thank you for being with me, and I look forward to talking with you again next week.